This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 92, brought to you in association with Blue Motor Finance and Smart Pension. And I'm delighted to be joined today by Bill Lazarnik, professor at the University of Massachusetts Lowell, whose research has been funded by the Institute for New Economic Thinking, a non-partisan, non-profit organization. INET is composed of real grown-ups. Lord Turner, who was on the show in LFP 065, is their governing board chairman, and its advisory board contained, or at least it did when it was formed, in 2009, six Nobel Prize winners in economics. Bill Lazarnik got his bachelor's degree in economics in the iconic 1968, his master's at the LSE, and his PhD at Harvard in 1975, and has written many books and an uncountably large number of economics papers to his name. I know it's uncountable, as I started counting and gave up at 100, where there were still several pages to go on the website. He's perhaps best known for his work on financialization, a process super relevant to finance. His iconic article, Profits Without Prosperity, Stock Buybacks Manipulate the Market and Leave Most Americans Worse Off, earned the HBR McKinsey Award for the best article in the Harvard Business Review in 2014. However, his work spans far more than this. According to his Wikipedia entry, his research seeks to understand, on the basis of innovative enterprise, how a national economy can achieve stable and equitable economic growth. Stable and equitable economic growth. Now, wouldn't that be a nice thing? Wikipedia continues. Lazarnik is the originator of the theory of the innovative enterprise, which he argues provides both an essential intellectual foundation for understanding economic performance and a fundamental critique of the neoclassical theory of the market economy. Much of his current work focuses on how the financialization of US industrial corporations, manifested in massive distributions of corporate cash to shareholders and the explosion of stock-based executive pay, results in employment instability and income inequity while undermining the innovative capability of the US economy. So Bill's work covers three important super big picture pillars for fintech: innovation, solid economic growth, and how corporates, i.e. incumbents, have changed in recent decades. It also adds in the surely socially vital angle of inequality. No point a tiny few of you fintechers out there achieving mega wealth if in a decade or two the dispossessed start burning down your chateau. Time for a real 30,000 feet episode today. I cannot emphasize enough that financial services is a social construct and itself very special subset, as it creates the money the rest use, of corporates per se. One whose form changes over time, reflecting developments in the jelly molds of regulation and the economy as a whole. One which either serves or screws the populace. Plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Hi, Bill. Thanks for joining me today.
Hi, Mike. It's great to be here. I'm actually here in London right now because of a grant from the Gatsby Foundation.
Is that the Great Gatsby or a Lesser Gatsby?
No, the David Sainsbury's Foundation. And I've gotten to know Lord Sainsbury over the last number of years. And he's gotten very interested in this tension between innovation and financialization in companies and in industry and the economy as a whole, and the implications for productivity, income distribution. So we're doing a project. This is being done with Professor Antonio Andreoni at SOAS, where I actually have an affiliation now, and doing a project on these issues focusing on the UK. That's just getting going. But my association with Britain goes way back. I was a master's student here in economics at London School of Economics in 1968-69.
When the world almost burnt down, or when your students wanted to burn it down.
That's right. There was a couple months during that year when the LSE buildings were closed down. We were locked out for uncivilized behavior, protesting.
What was the feeling at the time? Because, I mean, I was six, so I don't remember it particularly well. You were a little bit older than that, obviously, because you were at LSE. Was there a feeling at the time that real change was going to happen, or that just things were a bit crap and therefore you needed to protest?
There was a Vietnam War. That was the main focus. And of course, there had been 68, you know, May 68, particularly in France and other places, where protests had broken out on a widespread level with the notion of changing the world. The particular context of this was in October of 1968. There was going to be a big march in London, there was, against the war. And the students at LSE wanted to use the facilities for teach-ins and in case anybody got beat up, to take them there rather than the hospitals, because they get arrested at the hospital. So we voted to do this and took over the building for a weekend. And after that, the administration put up a bunch of iron gates on the stairwells so that if you tried to occupy the building again, they could keep you out. So students got together and then decided to take down the gates. It wasn't very difficult. If they weren't locked, you could just take a screwdriver. And so some people were actually thrown in jail for that.
Okay.
And then they locked the place down. In any case, it was an interesting place also because I was studying under a guy named Harry Johnson, who was a Chicago economist. And the Chicago economists really believe in this theory of the market economy. Then I went to Harvard and did a PhD there. It was much more liberal economists, not to a person. And they tended to hide behind the mathematics, pretend that they were going to be able to do something to ameliorate the problems of instability, unemployment, problems of income distribution, but really had no answer to the Chicago economists. So I kind of struck out, basically, to find the answer. And in doing this, I was not just concerned about talking to other economists. I come at this as an economist, but talking to other academics, learning from other academics. The world is an interdisciplinary place in a sense. And also, ultimately, in making the work that I do accessible to what I call informed citizens. And say for the last 10 years or so, I've been able to do that much more than I had been able to do earlier on because of the kind of the wealth of knowledge and kind of the theoretical perspective that I have developed over the years.
Let's come back to that. And it's interesting about this sort of potential revolution because we may end up in that direction. And yeah. It's all a bit sad these days because sort of wars go on nonstop. I think Obama was the first president to have constant wars for 8 years.
Yeah.
And Americans have been in Afghanistan forever. It's all a bit of a nightmare. And there isn't much protest, although we did have the Occupy movement, which I was very interesting and I went to speak to some people about. And actually, being at SOAS today, I've only been to SOAS twice, I think, in the last sort of 15 years. And both times, it's been a pleasure to hear elders talk. So early in 2000s, I got a little bit bored of doing finance and wanted to sort of use my brain a bit. And so I did a part-time degree in Buddhist studies on the University of Sunderland. Anyway, as part of that, I actually turned up at SOAS to hear Professor Richard Gombrich give his sort of retirement lecture. Professor Richard Gombrich was Bowdoin Professor of Sanskrit at Oxford from 1976 to 2004. And he was the older school kind of professor. And one of the stories that I remember from what he was saying was actually not about 1968, but he was saying that undergraduates often ask him for advice on how to get a job. And he said, I'm the worst person to ask, he said, because he said, I've only had one job in my life. And actually, they approached me and said, you know, would I like to be a professor of Sanskrit? And I wrote them a long, several-page letter about why I was completely inappropriate and utterly the wrong person to get it, as a result of which I've done this one job for my entire life. So the world has changed these days. So he feels he can't recommend to his undergraduates that when Morgan Stanley come knocking, they write a long letter about how poor they are. So talking about sort of old school academics and how things have changed and all that kind of stuff, you're now at University of Massachusetts Lowell. So how did that kind of happen?
I actually was an assistant associate professor at Harvard without tenure at that point. At that time, they actually said, although it wasn't always the case, that they didn't promote people internally and you weren't on a tenure track. But in any case, I then had a tenured position at Columbia University. I was in the part of Columbia called Barnard, which had its own economics department. And I was there from 1985 to 1993. But I also had developed a very close relation with Harvard Business School, particularly with business historians. And the great business historian was Alfred Chandler, who wrote about the managerial revolution in American business. So I got to know him very well during the 1980s. And I ended up, even when I wasn't formally associated with Harvard Business School, which I was for 2 years between 1984 and 86, coming there constantly to be part of seminar they had and to interact with people. Until, actually, it's an interesting little story, in 1992, when I presented in their seminar a paper called Controlling the Market for Corporate Control, the Historical Significance of Managerial Capitalism. It was in a big MBA amphitheater, 100 people, there probably was overflowing. And the discussant was a fellow named Michael C. Jensen, who was the guru of maximizing shareholder value and was the king of the hill at Harvard Business School. I wasn't there at the time. I was at Columbia. And, well, he was a little more than irate when he got up and realized that he had been asked to discuss someone who was criticizing him, because I guess I wasn't on his radar screen. And so he actually had me banned from Harvard Business School.
Oh, fantastic.
People can Google and find, if you look at Duff McDonald, the Golden Passport, Lozonic, Harvard Business School, you'll find the story. And actually Newsweek magazine had an article as a preview of Duff McDonald's book, The Golden Passport, about Harvard Business School, and I told him the story.
And managerial capitalism, just to relate it to the sort of the AFS audience, you guys were well ahead of your time because it wasn't happening so much then.
Yeah.
But basically, what it means, for the sake of argument, is that major investment banks at the moment, the managers tend to fill their own boots first, right, and then the shareholders.
And the industrial companies.
Yes,
I mean,
exactly,
all the companies, they're just saying the purpose is to get our stock price up. It's important because I actually witnessed that in the mid-1980s when I was at Harvard Business School. I was there again, formerly 84 to 86. And in 1985, the president of Harvard University and the dean of Harvard Business School went out of their way, went to get Michael Jensen to come there. He had been at the ultra conservative campus business school at the University of Rochester. He'd come out of University of Chicago arguing this stuff. And in 1984, nobody at Harvard Business School was talking about shareholder value. 1986, they're all talking about it. 1990, it was a dominant ideology.
Which is kind of Thatcher-Reagan stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, and of course, stuff was going on. It wasn't just because of that. There was this whole shift to Wall Street, the corporate raids, hostile raiders, and that's where the money was. And that's the Harvard Business School professors there, and you know, I meet many of them now who were there at the time, they didn't believe this stuff, but that's where the money was, and so the Harvard University Business School followed the money.
Exactly. Well, just pressing pause on that one is, again, going back to fintech, there's parallels. I mean, I was speaking to a journalist from a very well-known publication the other day who writes loads of articles on blockchain. I said, why do you do this? He said, well, I'm no interest at all, but I've got to do it because my editor said, I've got to do it, you know, because this is what sort of attracts audiences and that. And zooming up to the super big picture about academia in general, from outside academia, it's often thought that academics think. Now, of course, they do. That's absolutely true. But I came across a quote a while ago, and sadly I've forgotten who it was from, which says that man is not a thinking creature, man is a believing creature.
Okay, yes. Okay, well, because this gets to why I ended up leaving actually a tenured position in 1993 at Columbia University to go to a public university, University of Massachusetts Lowell, where I'm still on the faculty. The reason is because the way I do economics is to try to integrate facts and logic, theory and history.
That'd be nice.
Okay, so you have a theory of how the world works, but you then look at the facts. You presumably have based that theory on some studying the facts. In case we're talking about a process of change, innovation, development, you want to understand the process of change. And actually, I started earlier in my career studying the decline of the British economy. I became quite well known for that in the
1980s. We're still declining, don't worry.
Yeah. But then you use a theory to look at the facts, and then the facts should lead you to modify the way you think about the theory. If the theory isn't an end on its own, it's an engine of research and being able to dig deeper into the data and then make sense of the data. And I also talk about not just integrating theory and history, but catching up with history. And in a lot of the work I do on buybacks now and financialization and innovation also, it's being able to see how things are unfolding as they're unfolding. And for that, if you don't understand, kind of have a sense of history, actually Joseph Schumpeter called historical sense, you don't understand as things are happening, you don't have the insights of what to look at and how to see what's important that's going on.
But presumably what goes wrong, and this goes wrong in many sectors, just of human society, is that going back to this believing point and going back to being senior in an area, people attach their own reputation and ego to a certain perspective on life. And obviously it's most obvious in the political realm. You rarely get a senior Republican becoming a senior Democrat and vice versa, or over here between the Labour and Conservatives. So people grow up in a kind of almost like a religion, a belief system.
Yeah.
And we stay in our belief systems by ignoring the fact that, light is a particle, but actually it shows these wavelike things. Oh, no, let's just forget that. That's a sort of an inconvenient sort of fact. So people grow up like that. So senior folks, the elders in society, know stuff, but they're kind of, quite a lot of them end up stuck in from a certain perspective on the world. And the problem that I find, just in financial services, is that an upcoming generation, their 20s or something, can't possibly have the depth of knowledge and all that kind of thing.
Right. Yeah, so at Harvard Business School, I realized that there are people who, notwithstanding this domination of shareholder value ideology that I saw come in the 90s and the 80s, is that there are people who were dealing with companies and understood a lot of stuff that I wanted to understand. So I
got actually there a much better sense of the importance of interdisciplinary study, particularly because Harvard Business School didn't tend to hire people from business schools. They tend to hire people from various social sciences. And so in 1993, I was working in New York but living in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and I met the chancellor of University of Massachusetts Lowell, an engineer named Bill Hogan, who just recently died, and we hit it off right away. And he said we could do something there that could bring the various disciplines together and think about how this could be relevant to what was going on in the regional economy. This is the Boston area, so the regional economy is affected by the global economy. And we built a program, a master's program called Regional Economic and Social Development, which was extremely successful for a university that, on the social science side, had a lot of good people. You get a lot of good people, particularly if you're in your Boston area at a university, but not any kind of reputation for this. And by the way, people don't just get tied to a belief, they get tied to being at Harvard or MIT. And that becomes their life, and I saw that too. And that can be a little stultifying, actually. So, you know, this was somewhat liberating. Unfortunately, as things worked out, in my theory of innovative enterprise, which we'll be coming to, one of the critical things is who exercises strategic control. Because the people who decide how to allocate resources can have a big impact on what's going on.
That's a fascinating question, actually. At the moment, and this may come up on podcast next year, I'm actually conducting a study. So far, I've spoken to about 19 chief executives of fintechs about what a fintech needs from its board when it's a startup, when it's a scale-up, when it's a grown-up company.
Yes,
by the time a fintech out there becomes a FTSE 100 company, there's a million boxes, a PC boxes. You've got to tick all this stuff, and there's bureaucracy. Everyone knows that. You try and do that as a startup, it'll kill you. Actually, I've had almost 100% response from the people I've reached out to. Because they all say this is a fascinating topic. And actually, we've read next to nothing about what a board is in a startup, what is a board in a scale-up. And the point you're making there about who controls the strategy is one of the interesting things. So far, I've just got a million research notes, and I'm completely confused. Because you know what it's like. You speak to dozens of people. They get a dozen views.
This is of critical importance.
Absolutely. Do the VCs control it? Do the management control it? How does the balance of power change over time?
You know, Americans are finding this out with this guy who's a total moron and self-serving, whatever he is, a guy who's the president of the United States. I mean, he's not really a moron at all. He's just totally greedy and self-serving and self-absorbed and narcissistic. But you know, look at what happens. And I saw this on a much smaller scale at University of Massachusetts Lowell. Our Chancellor Hogan retired. They brought in a politician. He had no notion of what we were doing and that's its importance. And we had created a few enemies within the faculty there. And they overnight destroyed the program. So the program no longer exists. It was, in my view, almost a virtual crime because you took something at a public university that was having a big impact and now it's totally missed. I'm still a professor there and I have other ways of doing my research. The university, fortunately, is much less importance. It's important for where you get your money and where you get a job. It's important in terms of your teaching your students. And, of course, I really enjoy that, and I still teach my students. But we live in an interconnected world, so we can do research very collaboratively with people around the world.
There's interesting parallels there, because for many fintechs, they have innovated. They are creating, in almost like an artistic sense, something new that never existed before. They'll create it. And at some point, some big corporate will kill it, and they'll sell out. We see it time and time again.
They won't, yeah. So it's really a question of who has control. And that's actually what this ideology of shareholder value is all about.
So maybe let's dive into the shareholder value one first, and we'll touch on the innovation second. So I noticed a recent paper of yours, which I'll just quote from the sort of the overview. Since the late 1980s, the dominant ideology of corporate governance in the United States has been that, for the sake of superior economic performance, companies should maximize shareholder value, MSV. As promulgated by agency theorists, for the sake of argument for the moment, that means the management is there on behalf of the shareholder doing stuff.
Yeah.
As promulgated by agency theorists, however, MSV, maximizing shareholder value, is an ideology of value extraction, which you certainly see in investment banks and that kind of stuff, just filling their own boots, that lacks a theory of value creation. And then another point that I like, because actually I thought about this decades ago, but there's nowhere to go with this one for me, which is that the most fundamental error is the assumption that public shareholders invest in the productive assets of the corporation. They do not. They allocate, so you write, their savings to the purchase of the shares and are willing to do so as liquidity means they can sell. And one prime example of this is that Apple's only capital raise was in 1980. So when people say, oh, Apple is returning capital to its, well, its shareholders, it is the shareholders literally, but it's actually not returning the capital that was founded. Yeah. It ain't returned any. So it's much more nuanced than it appears.
Yeah. So you got to start with, first of all, what makes an economy productive? There's investments that are made by governments in infrastructure and knowledge that even the biggest businesses couldn't do without and wouldn't make those investments themselves. There's investments that are made by millions of households. In the United States, there's about 80 million family households. That's households with children. You're investing in the future labor force. You're investing in yourselves. If those investments are not made, you don't have a productive economy.
Just in terms of make sure the listeners understand what you mean by that, having read some of your work, tiny, tiny bit of it, when you say you investment, you're meaning in the broader sense. You're not meaning in the financial sense. You're not meaning writing
a
check.
No, I don't mean, so the notion that you have some money, you put it into some security, you get a yield. You might call that a portfolio investment. And of course, in the theories of international trade, there's a difference between portfolio investment, direct investment. I'm talking about direct investment that invests in productive capability.
In societies. In your ability to speak languages, in my health, in your fitness.
Yeah, and our ability to take resources and turn them into something else. So you need the people to do that. You need the infrastructure. And then you have business enterprises. And business enterprises don't just transform inputs into outputs. They can do that, but if that's all they're doing, you just have a bunch of commodities out there. You do not have a productive society. Business enterprises have to produce high-quality products that are doing things that we couldn't do before. At least that's what's going to drive the growth of the economy. But you can't just have the highest quality products if they're too costly. So they have to be able to produce those high quality products at low unit costs, and they can pass some of that, the profits they get as a result of getting a competitive advantage of that onto their buyers in the form of lower prices, onto their employees in the form of job security and higher wages, which in many ways is a reward for being involved in this innovation process, to the government for supplying them with the infrastructure and the knowledge, and to shareholders who just buy and sell shares in the company, typically in the form of dividends. Now, when you have a company, just going to what the business enterprises do in this, that's a startup, if it's just going to produce what everybody else is going to producing, then it's not going to succeed because some others will already have the products out there, have the market, the economies of scale, and often the cost of accessing the market, the brand name and the advertising, even though we put them on the profit and loss statements and not on balance sheets, also we put R&D on profit statements as current costs, not on balance sheet. They are assets, and the people are assets. So if you start a company, you have to produce something that some buyers are going to see as higher quality, as something that they can would rather buy your product than someone else's. Just to do that, you have to have someone making a decision to do this, what I call strategic control, that we can do it. And if it's something that doesn't already exist, which by definition is what innovation is, then you're facing the uncertainty about whether you can succeed in doing this. To confront that uncertainty, I call it technological market competitive uncertainty, but basically there's different types of uncertainty you have to confront. You have to actually put together a learning organization, because how do you find out, how do you figure out how to produce a higher quality product? You have to have some learning. So you bring some people together and they start developing, let's say, some software program, some app or some new machine or whatever they're trying to do. Those people are going to be spending time and money, because you're going to pay these people, to engage in a learning process. That's actually fixed costs that you're incurring, because fixed costs are defined as costs that you incur irrespective of the output you sell.
Exactly. And most fintechs are in that stage still, so that many of them after 5 years are still losing money. All this cost, they're discovering what the market will buy.
And you may never be successful, and that's because it's uncertain. So this is why, first of all, strategic control is important, because you have to have people who are willing to confront that uncertainty. Now, they may think that if I succeed, I'm going to be very rich, but those same people could go somewhere else and make a very good living, usually working for some existing companies. I would say if they're going to be successful in this, they understand that industry, they have a certain passion for the kind of products they want to produce, and then they got to get these people to work with them. Now, they don't own the people, so the people can go off somewhere else, so they have to keep that learning organization together. So think of Steve Jobs developing, you know, the iPhone. You had to keep a certain number of people together or the whole thing would fall apart. And there, some people were more important than others. How many people were key? Maybe 600, whatever. It's very hard to know. But you could find that out if you had enough access to information. But that's what I call organizational integration. So you have two principles there of innovative enterprise: strategic control, the ability and incentives of people who run the company, the integrating the efforts and the skills of people into a learning process to actually develop something that other companies can't produce. And then the third thing you need is financial commitment, because you have to sustain that process until you can actually sell the product. And as I said, often not just developing the technology, but accessing the market, convincing the market that you have a better product. Now, once you access the market, if in fact you have a product that people see as innovative and something they can't get, you'll start getting a larger share of the market, and then you'll start spreading out those fixed costs. And so you'll get some economies of scale. And it might be an industry where economies of scale are extremely important, might be somewhere they're not as important, but you'll get economies of scale. And that will drive down your unit costs. And you can be in a position as an innovative enterprise where in the end, once you succeed, you're blowing everybody out of the water because you have a higher quality product that you can produce at low unit costs, and you can strategically price this to try to get a larger market or to make more profits now. And then you also can say, well, we're going to do with it. Innovative enterprises often don't pay any dividends. They certainly don't do stock buybacks. They put the money back into the organization and growth, and actually retained earnings is the most fundamental. Once you get past the initial stage, you might have some kind of venture capital. Now we have, since the United States, since the 1970s, it's only that recent that we have an organized venture capital industry. But you find some friends and family, some support associates who put money at the beginning. But once you get to the point where you have profits, it's a retained earnings support.
Just on that one, to make that one clear. So in the case of where the capital comes from to provide Apple's growth, you've explained the process very well. They're now making, I've forgotten, it's either 12 or 20 billion a month or quarter profit, yeah, massive. Yeah. So the vast majority of capital that has built Apple to where it is today has come from making a profit. I.e. has come from actually the buyers of the product and the workers who are creating that, as well as the sort of clever thinky people who make the nice design stuff as well. So the vast majority of the capital there, and for example, if you're returning value to the capital providers, in theory, if we imagine a completely different world on Mars, you might say, oh, what a company does, actually, it gives some of the money back to the original capital providers, and it gives some of the money to all the buyers over the last decade because they helped get it where it was, and it gives some of the money back to the workers.
And to the government.
And to the government for providing roads, education.
Yeah, and to be able to do that again and reproduce those conditions at least for the other companies. And okay, so the case of Apple is quite clear. I mean, you had this kind of business genius, young guy, Steve Jobs. He meets a technological genius, Steve Wozniak, who can put together the most efficient motherboards using components that are available, including, of course, microprocessors, which Apple could never have produced on its own. And Steve Jobs happens to grow up 20 minutes drive away from Xerox PARC, which was an old economy company that had created the computer.
And loads of great ideas like Windows and that.
Well, the graphical user interface, yeah.
Exactly. Microsoft and Apple didn't invent most of the stuff that they just popularized and got it out there.
No, and basically what happened is in 1978, they had the Apple I, which was just a motherboard that was sold, and then the Apple II was just putting a case on it. Because venture capital now was around, they were a hot property. They got a guy to back them who had made his money from Intel. And then all of a sudden, other entities wanted to put money into Apple. And so Xerox wanted to put $1 million into Apple. And Apple was in the position at this point, or it's a very young company, of saying, we'll let you do this if you show us your technology.
Oh, that's the bit I didn't know. Yeah.
So they got 3 days at Xerox PARC. And they went there.
With their cameras.
And they showed them stuff that they already knew about. And Jobs himself might have just left and said, okay, well, thank you. But it happened, and here, who else is working with you importantly? There's a guy named Jeff Raskin, who ended up being the head of the development of the Macintosh, the Mac, which was the first big successful Apple computer and used the graphical user interface, which was an advantage that Apple had right up to 1995 when Windows finally came up with it. So, you know, this wasn't an easy thing to do. And he said, I know that they have a graphical user interface here. Now, how did this guy know this? He had gotten a PhD in 1967.
Oh, wow.
In computer science on graphical user interfaces.
Which is phenomenal, because yeah. I did my stuff in the early 80s. It didn't exist.
Yeah, you know, to have that guy next to you yeah. and part of your yeah. organization, a very small organization, made all the difference. And so they said, no, we're not leaving here until you show us that. We know you have it. And the person who was originally showing them stuff, apparently, according to the story, and I think it was written up in Walter Isaacson's biography of Jobs, a guy came forward, I forget his name, and he said, yes, I'll show it to you. That guy, within a year, had left Xerox PARC and gone to Apple. He saw an individual opportunity, but that's how they got that. Okay, so then when they went public, 1980, this was, first of all, a year when kind of venture capital made its biggest splash in Apple. There was also in biotech, Genentech went public, huge IPOs. Apple raised $97 million on the stock market. That was of some consequence, but not important for Apple even then, because it was already had a product that it was selling and was taking off and had a lot of venture capital backing. The main purpose then and now of the IPO was to allow the venture capitalists to get their money back.
Liquidity event, yes.
Now, Steve Jobs could cash in some of his shares. Wozniak cashed in his shares, started running these rock concerts and stuff like this. They could hold their shares, but now you had the option. Once it's on the stock market, anytime you want, you can sell the shares. When Steve Jobs got pushed out in 1985, he sold every single share of Apple that he held. So even Steve Jobs, when he came back, was not an investor in Apple. So anybody who, since 1980, bought or sold shares, even if they're holding the shares now, they weren't investing in Apple. They weren't investing in an uncertain process. Anytime they want, they can go and sell the shares. Okay, so summer of 2013, we've written a long piece on this, on how Carl Icahn, the corporate raider, took basically $2 billion by just holding Apple shares. He bought, on the market, $3.6 billion in Apple shares. Anybody who can get access to $3.6 billion today can go and buy $3.6 billion of Apple shares. No one's going to stop you, and someone be willing to sell it to in a highly liquid market. He was astute. He bought it when the price had been at a peak in 2012, was low. When we've written about this, it's on the iNet website. Basically, he used his visibility, his wealth, a bunch of hype, which was actually nonsense about the future revenues of Apple. And his influence, he was always talking about talking to Tim being Tim Cook and the board, the CEO of Apple. And he may have had some information about what was going on in China, because it turns out that when no one knew that January to March of 2016, Apple sales to China had gone down a lot, he happened to have sold his shares by the end of March, we know that, and no one knew about this until April. Okay, there are ways in which people who are in the business of making money just by buying and selling shares are able to do it. During 2014, 2015, one of the things that helped get Apple shares up and keep them up was $81 billion in stock buybacks. Largest buybacks in both those years, 1 year, $45 billion, next year, $36 billion, ever been done in history. And Apple did that solely to manipulate its stock price.
And one of the reasons for doing that, of course, is coming back to this sort of agency theory of managerial capitalism, is that, funnily enough, as we all know, executives end up with sort of huge stock bonuses, options, blah, blah, blah. And funnily enough, by taking an action for the entire company, they actually make loads of money for themselves.
In the Harvard Business Review article you mentioned, I go through the reasons that are given why companies do buybacks. I won't go into all of them here now, but basically I refute those, and the reason is executives are incentivized to do this with stock options and stock awards. So they're structured in a way that if you get the stock price up, you cash in. So you cash in, and then when the Carl Icahn comes along, or some of these other corporate, what they call hedge fund activists, or call them corporate raiders, buy up your shares, say, we, you know, create value for us. Back in the 80s, they used to call that hostile. Now no one calls it hostile. They're all in bed together on this.
Hypernormalization is the phrase used over here.
Yeah, and just one more point about Apple, and then we'll go to the bigger picture. Apple actually calls this their capital return program. They never gave them anything. Carl Icahn never gave Apple one penny. So why are they returning money to him? Okay, now, If you look at the whole U.S. economy, basically back in 1982, the Security Exchange Commission, which had been captured by Chicago economists as a result of the election of Ronald Reagan, passed the rule, it's called Rule 10b-18, which basically says that a company will not be charged with manipulating the market if they abide by a certain set of rules in terms of repurchasing stock on the open market. And basically, it was giving them a license to manipulate the market. So Apple can do, under those rules, without having any fear of being charged manipulating the market, 1.4 billion or 1.5 billion of stock buybacks per day.
Per day.
Day after day after day. And we don't even know when they're doing them. There's also something that they've used and other companies use that we're writing about now called an accelerated share repurchase.
So it's basically creating a false market using insider information, isn't it?
Yeah. And some people know when this is going on. We don't. Even if we knew it, it would still be a manipulation of the market, and it would not be a good thing to do because it's taking the retained earnings of companies and it's using them to prop up stock prices. Now, the traditional way, if someone buys shares in a company and give them a yield, is dividends. And that's fine because we as households need to save our money. And if we can get from public companies a dividend.
What you're talking about, innovation, will be exactly what people have been experiencing in the fintech world here. They see how it turns into corporatism and financialization and a very different sort of uninnovative world, like your story of the university, eventually sort of management change and, you know, the thing that they created in the first place is killed off. One of the things that happens in large organizations, which is precisely why fintech is here in the financial services, is that large organizations have utterly changed from what they started as, if they started a little one went the way. Huge bureaucracy and that kind of stuff, which doesn't innovate. So prime examples are actually Apple and Google and others. I mean, Apple has got this vast cash pile, which clearly it's unable to use itself to innovate.
Yeah.
So actually, in terms of how you can get more innovation, which you argue clearly is required, then in some way, look, if you guys can't use that money, give it to somebody else, because then maybe they can use it. Yeah, so the point is, we need to get the money out of these sort of companies.
Okay, so Apple's a somewhat special case because it's so successful and will continue to be for some time, although not with competition. But the bigger problem is that in the economy as a whole, and of course, to some extent you have this in Europe, but I'll just talk about the United States, this distribution to shareholders has become an obsession. And if it was just dividends, and I would say to institutional investors, if you are holding these shares and you're not in the business of buying and selling shares, you don't want buybacks because you want the company to be paying enough dividends so it can reinvest. You can get an income, but then those shares are going to be worth something in the future. The only way you make money from buybacks is by selling the shares and by timing the selling of shares, at least the type of buybacks we're talking about, these open market repurchases, and knowing when to do this. You might get it not quite exactly right, but there are people who are in the business of doing this, and they're the ones who are, including the top executives, and they're the ones who are making all the money. Now, who is losing the money? The workers who thought that in helping develop these products, they would have a career and they would get the gains from this. The taxpayers who put the money in, and under a system where there's a reasonable tax rate, you're getting that money back. What do these companies do? They say we need lower taxes to make more profits. Apple has a whole division, and it's not unique, which is aimed at lowering its tax bill. So companies, when they start not just paying dividends, but they start doing buybacks, they really start depleting the retained earnings, and they don't care, ultimately, if they're cannibalizing the company. If they're just, and they call this creating value for shareholders.
Exactly, and they don't care if they're cannibalizing societies. So if I start a coffee shop tomorrow, I'm competing against Starbucks. Starbucks, because it's got clever accountants and lawyers, won't bother paying much taxes. I'll have to pay it. Yeah. So there's no way you can innovate very easily in the coffee shop.
So my view on Apple is, I think if Jobs had lived, he probably wouldn't have done these buybacks because of his own ego and because he knew how that company was built. Tim Cook, who was a supply chain guy, he has to somewhere, unless he's just so kind of brainwashed, know that Carl Icahn is not an investor in the company. But he goes and has dinner with him. He calls it a capital return program. Now, he could have said, no, Apple has huge benefits by being part of the American economy, government investment, not just in general, but in particular technologies that are used in the Apple products. And we want to recreate the society that put us in place, because it actually was one where tax rates were quite high, and it was one where the government, and to this day, still invests. He could say, the workers who work for us, we want to make these the best jobs, including the people in the Apple stores, anywhere possible. So let's You know, we don't need to double their pay.
And of course, the fact that this has gone wrong means politically, and it sounds like you're not President Trump's number one supporter, it means politically that a lot of people, the middle class in America, prime example, but around the world, a lot of people know that they're losing out. The 1% or the 1%...
Well, they are losing out. And
is gaining more and more. Yeah. And therefore, anybody who turns up and says, well, this is all going a bit wrong, will go, oh, we'll vote for him.
So just to put it in perspective, for the last decade, for the companies in the S&P 500 index, we look at 461 companies listed over 2007-2016. We look at their earnings, their profits, and then we look at buybacks and dividends. For those companies, almost 55% of their profits went to buybacks, is about $4 trillion, and another 39% went to dividends. That's another $2.9 trillion. That's almost $7 trillion going out to shareholders. Almost all the profits, a lot of the other profits, actually, and more past profits, are held abroad under some tax laws that protect some U.S. taxation, and now they're trying to change that to let them bring them back at about 5%, and they'll do a lot more buybacks with them. Companies are borrowing to do buybacks. Many companies spend decade after decade, and it goes back three decades now, over 100% of their net income on buybacks. So at some point, they're eating into their capital, they're selling off assets, they're borrowing money, laying off workers. It's not unusual for companies to lay off perfectly good workers to do buybacks. So the net result of all this is concentration of income at the top. We see that. This is a prime mode of which this is happening. Not the only one, but a prime mode in which it's happening. Loss of middle-class jobs, because middle-class jobs are created by having good jobs with companies over a prolonged period of time. And the downward mobility of the working class. And that gets you not just economic disaster, it gets you political disaster, which has a name now, T-R-U-M-P. I mean, it's a total political disaster.
Coming back to this, to the super big picture here, so let's move forward to the corporatism and perhaps where it goes and perhaps 1968 again and all that kind of stuff. So what you say is very well laid out, and it probably makes sort of the listeners roll their eyes about sort of economists as a whole, that a lot of this, which is frankly self-evidently true, it can actually have been controversial at various points in time. We all know that Jack Welch, GE in the 60s, was pushing this as an idea. It was an interesting idea at the time. But then Apologia Pro Vita Sua in an FT interview, he said, oh, it's the craziest idea ever invented or something like that. So we've all moved on. And in particular, this 1%ism or the 1% of the 1%ism, there was some research last year which has completely escapes my mind now, which looked at the correlation between what the US public think and whether a bill gets passed graded against sort of income level. If you're a poor American, what you think tends to be the opposite of what happens in the bill. If the average American, it makes no difference whatsoever. And if you're with a tiny, tiny amount at the top, it makes a huge difference. So basically the wealthy and the corporates have kind of bought the politicians by now, and the two are in cahoots around the world. My partner's sons, they're in young 20s, they're sort of very politically interested, and they use phrases like capitalism and socialism and this kind of stuff. And I've heard those phrases myself, and they're kind of really interesting. 100 years ago, talking about capitalism and socialism might be very interesting. But what I think we have at the moment is none of the above. I mean, you know, you can call it corporatism in every economic sector, whether it's telecoms or airlines or pharma. You've got a few vast companies and you've got the state. Or you can call it fascism insofar as Mussolini defined fascism as the collaboration of the state and the corporate. Or sitting in an economics professor's room here, there's a book about MITI over there, the Japanese trade industry thing. Or you can just call it the Asian way, in Korea and Japan are being built on giant zaibatsu and the states together. Now, in this world of corporatism, fascism, or sort of zaibatsus, my concern, and we touched on this last week in terms of the pensions so-called crisis in the UK and what's happening in terms of a risk transfer from the corporate to the individual and from the state to the individual. The state says, oh, you've got to work more, work more, work more, which basically means they've stolen the money. This corporatism isn't serving the people. This comes back to my jokey introduction at the beginning. If fintech as a whole, one or two people end up billionaires and they own chateaus in France, but everybody else is dispossessed and their families are starving, their houses will be burnt down. We will get a revolution by the middle of the century, is my current feel. So in terms of where this is all going, Bill, where, as somebody who saw 1968 and you saw the Occupy and you've been working on a lot of the mechanisms behind how this is happening and how economies can be prosperous, where do you think it's all going and how will it be fixed? Because I can't actually see. It's very hard to see a system of militarization around the world, of corporations with vast power. David Graeber, who was the Occupy, also wrote Debt the First 5,000 Years, and he's now an academic at the LSE, as I'm sure you know, he said, well, you know, regularly the United States comes at the bottom of the table of corruption around the world. So it's obviously a very uncorrupt country. He says, and he laughs, and this is because in America they've legalized bribery. Yes. It's just called lobbying. How can we get out of this? Yeah. So, how will your grandchildren be living not in a corporatist world?
Yeah, so I think that we can't do without large corporations in certain industries. There's no doubt that some are just growing large, consolidating so that they can control the markets, so that they control other companies and pump even more money out of those companies. But that's the fundamental problem, is what these companies are doing in terms of allocation of resources. It's a fundamental problem with economics, which the view is that the market allocates resources. These corporations allocate resources, and the markets are really the outcomes. Now, are we going to get good outcomes or bad outcomes? Depends on how these corporations allocate resources. So we have to do a number of things. One, which is actually should be ideologically a very difficult thing to do, politically an easy thing to do, is ban these buybacks, these open market repurchases. Turns out they were never ratified by the U.S. Congress, and they have been illegal in certain places, are illegal in certain places. Just say that companies can't do it, that they're a manipulation of the market, doesn't mean that you're getting rid of the stock market, doesn't mean you're getting rid, you're actually increasing the probability and security of being able to pay dividends to people who are really holding shares. And recognize, the second thing is recognize those people are not investors in the companies, they're just portfolio investors or savers. But then we do need to govern these companies.
What about compensation? Because one thing that sticks in my mind is like J.P. Morgan had this thing about the ratio that the top of J.P. Morgan back in the day, and he was an arch capitalist in the old sense, could only earn 30 times the poorest. If you or I were global dictator tomorrow, we could put in a rule that stayed forever. We say, okay, 30 times or something. Yeah. I.e. the managers just can't steal from the company.
That's right. Yeah. So part of the process that allows that to occur is that, first of all, there's this notion that companies should be run for shareholders. You've got to change that.
Thinking of my younger members of the audience, it will seem absolutely heretical and mad and illogical to them, especially the ones that have been trained by most economic courses, that the companies aren't there for the shareholders. But a lot of these things are social conventions. So go back to the days of the 70s or 80s in the UK. There was a culture around companies. I've mentioned on the show before, in the UK it used to be called personnel departments, which came from the army. Yeah. In the army, you look after your men, because your men may save your life. Yeah. You've got to look after your men. And that was the kind of personnel. It was the same kind of paternalistic, if you like, attitude. But then it became this kind of, you know, businessified resources, and they were just a resource to be bought and sold.
Yeah.
But it was perfectly possible to, quote, have capitalism using the word.
Oh, no, not only possible, this was...
It was desirable, but, it, you know, companies, back in the day when I was a kid and when I was growing up, companies would have felt embarrassed by sacking loads of workers. Oh, that's a terrible thing for our reputation. We don't want to do that.
That's true in the United States. And so it went from what I call it from a retain and reinvest allocation regime, where you retained your people and your money and you reinvested in productive capabilities, to a downsize and distribute. You basically lay off workers, cut the pay of the people who are there, cut their benefits, and offshore around the world, and don't worry about the fact that these people helped to build the company up. And you distribute all the profits to shareholders. And that's basically what has gone on. It doesn't mean there are no companies that don't do this. You do have some companies that are on a kind of still retain and reinvest trajectory. But once they become successful, all the vultures are there, including from the inside and the outside, take them out. Now, among those are the top executives who become advocates of shareholder value ideology. And the work we've done in executive pay shows that in the United States, if you take the 500 highest paid executives in the United States, 2015, about $33 million on average in total remuneration. 84% of that was stock-based. And the way that the stock options, stock awards are structured is you get the stock price up, you cash in, even if the company goes to hell, you've made your money. Okay, so you got to change that. So two things. Put different people on the boards, change the ideology of the company, put representatives of taxpayers and workers on the boards.
For example, like Germany, where you have to have worker representatives.
And I think Germany, where there's lots of pressure for financialization, but it's been stifled by the fact that you have co-determination. Any company over 500 people has workers represented on the board. In the United States, I wouldn't say that the current unions are the ones that should supply those representatives. You have to have worker representatives who really understand what's going on in those companies. And you need taxpayers. You know, when I pay tax in the United States, I'm subsidizing companies. And if I don't get those companies, even if with a good tax rate, if those companies aren't profitable, we don't get our tax revenues. So I want someone on there representing me on every public corporation.
saying, how are you using taxpayers' money and how are we ensuring that the taxpayers get a return? And we are actually getting a return because we did put something in. The workers are getting a return because they put their effort in. Okay, so then you would then say, well, executive pay, well, we don't want to use stock price to represent it because actually stock price, it can represent innovation, but it often represents speculation. It's driven by speculation and often by manipulation. And if it isn't stock buybacks, it's by rumors, it's by false information, it's by all kinds of things. So we want executives to be paid by some other set of metrics that reflect the innovative enterprise. How much learning's going on there, new products, the longevity of employment of workers who are getting experience about producing these products. You can have lots of other metrics, and people have it for various in various contexts said, what are the metrics by which you would measure innovation? Let's do that and pay executives according to that, a set of rules. And the other thing is that I think we need to recognize in a world of even the largest corporations that we live in a global economy and corporations are going to have difficulty remaining innovative over time under any circumstances. So sometimes they should break themselves up. Sometimes
the government, like AT&T,
and they shouldn't just grow bigger and bigger.
And also, actually, a different angle, we don't have time for this one, but a lot of vast oligopoly is held in place by regulation, of course.
Yeah, and so rather than break up corporations because corporators come in there and sell off the pieces, it's not very difficult for a company to spin off a business unit and say, okay, it should be running itself because the people who have to exercise strategic control have to have more control. They can't be part of this big organization. So that is a very healthy decision to be made if you're thinking about not about your company getting bigger and bigger and you getting more and more powerful, but about creating an innovative economy. It often means that people within the organization can go out and start running their own company. And this has been done. Actually, the Japanese have been very good at doing this. And American companies, once in a while, they do it from an innovation perspective. So there's lots of things that can be done, but it requires a fundamental change in corporate governance and change in ideology of corporate governance. And that's what we're kind of
working on,
confronting at now. And we're trying to show people even before that, you know, what the costs are of not doing that. The economic costs, the political costs, the social costs.
What I like about that is that one of my concerns about all this sort of corporatism and militarism and all that kind of stuff is that I haven't been able to see, just sort of intellectually, what the simple way out is. What I quite like in the sort of your 1968 sense is that you're still, in a sense, working to change society and fix it, and that you've got some specific policy proposals, which, if they were implemented, I mean, I think, you know, we would add something like massive simplification. I would add something like massive simplification. So, for example, just scrap all these sort of taxes and things and say, oh, there's a sales tax on the company. So any iPhone sold here, 20% of that is taxed. Yeah. Job done. Something simple. Like, it could be done if they wanted.
Lots of ways you could do that.
Lots of ways. So there are some policy prescriptions. I think I'm still a bit pessimistic because I can't quite see how turkeys vote for Christmas. Either sort of 0.1% are going to vote against this, unless they start to see that actually people are going to burn their chateau down. But what I also like is that when Lord Turner, other iNet person on the show, was on, he was talking about how policy and change actually happens. And he was talking about the fact that actually how it works. And it's a bit like you guys in the early 90s talking about managerial capitalism, is that actually the job of artists at best is to channel sort of beauty and truth and where things are going and reflect society itself. And the job of academics at best is to think about the problems as they are now, is to research it to make sure they're well-grounded in fact, and is actually to come up with some policy proposals. The point that Lord Turner made is that actually, from those policy proposals having been created and having existed as a body of work, they're kind of like seeds that are scattered.
Yeah.
They have to land on ground that's fertile, the rain has to come along, some politician, I mean, example of Thatcher and Reagan at the time. The academic work, according to Adair, that led to that had been done decades before, but actually we kind of sat around for ages until some politicians went, ah, we'll have that, that's just what we need. So I suspect that what's going to happen with a lot of this stuff is the difference between perhaps your optimism and my pessimism is perhaps one of timescale, which is that if things are to work out, then almost in a sense they've got to do something mutatis mutandis, like what you're talking about, to change society. I think the only question is, will it happen in a decade or 2 decades or 3 decades?
Yeah.
We don't know that little bit. It's the thing, it reminds me of the thing about in finance, which I learned very well at an early age in the city, which is that if you're going to give a forecast, give a level or a date, but never both at the same time. So before we wrap up the show, I'd like to thank all our listeners out there and my brand partners of the podcast. Blue Motor Finance combine extensive experience with a fresh and innovative approach Blue's award-winning technology has supported over £500 million of lending to over 50,000 customers. Smart Pension, who are fast, secure and free. Check out their UK workplace pensions at autoenrolment.co.uk. So thank you very much for that sort of tour de force, Bill, of sort of lecture, a whole bunch of stuff and pulling it together. It must be a nightmare being asked to basically reprise your last sort of 40 years work. What would you like to flag wave to the thousands of folks listening out there that you're up to and that they can check out your work further?
Yeah, well, first of all, as I said, the Institute for New Economic Thinking, which really ramped up in 2010, they have been funding a lot of my research, in part because of the destruction of the program I had at UMass Lowell, this regional economic social development, which happened just at the same time. Coincidentally, I took a lot of the students who were working with me, and we together co-founded an organization, a tax-exempt organization called the Academic Industry Research Network. And so INET and the Academic Industry Research Network have kind of, in a sense, grown together. They're much a bigger organization, but we've been had a lot of generous funding from them, and they've found our research useful and help to promote the dissemination of our research. And one of the things that we're trying to do, and we're just working out, we've got it all in place, working out the financing of this, is we want people to know about just the problem of buybacks as they're going on, how they're doing damage. It's not the only thing that's going on, but it's a center of a corrupt system. So hopefully within the next month or two, we'll launch a website called the Buyback Economy Blog, or Buyback Economy Blog, which is basically the notion of a buyback economy, which is saying this is so extreme that the U.S. economy is something done where the main activity you do as a company is buy back your stock. And we're going to have on there the literally hundreds of articles that have cited our own research, my research and the research of my colleagues at the Academic Industry Research Network, which is actually a lot of those colleagues are in Europe as well, in Asia and other places. And we're going to have various video presentations of this. A very good one was done by Harvard Business Review, a 10-minute video, which was of the video of the article that you mentioned. There have been a number of politicians in the United States and now increasingly in other countries who have recognized this problem. So in the United States, the most well-known ones who have talked about this have been former Vice President Joe Biden. He's a big fan of the Harvard Business Review article and even had an article in the Wall Street Journal about a little over a year ago on this problem, citing our research. Senator Tammy Baldwin, who's a senator from Wisconsin, who is taken up this issue and written letters under the Obama administration to the Securities and Exchange Commission saying, why are you doing this? Just in the recent confirmations of hearings of commissioners to the Securities and Exchange Commission, there's only five of them, and two people were being up for being kind of interrogated by senators about going on the commission. There's a senator from Hawaii named Brian Schatz who basically said what was in our research about the damage the buybacks do, and said to the commissioners who were being nominated, what are you going to do about it? And the one who was the Democratic nominee said that, yes, he agreed this was a big problem. They'll do something about it. Whether they will or not is another question. I think in Europe, probably Elizabeth Warren is well known as a senator who has talked about this. Bernie Sanders should be talking about this, but he hasn't really. I mean, he talks about how the billionaires rig the political system, but not about how they get rich. But this is, we're trying to have an influence on people who can actually change policy. And the Buyback Economy blog is going to be somewhere where hopefully people will see all the discussion that's going on about this in one place, be able to contribute their own experiences, maybe even working within companies and telling us why companies do this and the damage it does. People in corporations don't like to talk about these things because I think if you start saying, you know, criticizing stuff from within, it might not be there very long. If you, particularly if you have no about these things, sort of, we see all this stuff coming out about sexual harassment, assault. People were silent about a lot of stuff that people know about. On the economic level, this is very damaging stuff that people in there know is damaging, but nobody's really talking about it who knows what's actually going on. So we want to give some voice to this from people who are actually experiencing the process of making these decisions, knowing it's wrong, and knowing that people are getting laid off, the damage is done, how it's killing innovation. So look out for that. And also, finally, look out for this project we're doing here in the UK.
funded by the Gatsby Foundation over the next couple of years, because we'll have publications which are on this set of issues of financialization, buybacks, executive pay, the way in which making decisions according to shareholder value ideology affects a whole lot of other decisions you make, affects the way you relate to the government. So we hope to have quite a bit of work done within the next couple of years on the situation in the UK, which kind of is not as dire as the US, but it is a big problem.
Thank you very much for that, Bill. It's really pleasing to hear that people are actually working on these challenges. Most of the people I speak to are sort of kind of in denial largely because it's easiest just to ignore terrible things like Iraq war and all this kind of stuff and confront them day to day. But in terms of the economic part of it, it's very good that people are working on it. And also, you know, I like your point about the interest from some politicians. I mean, we all quite like to, and I'm as guilty as most, if not more, of just sort of slurring politicians. They go, well, politicians, of course, you know, it's all corrupt, blah, blah, blah. But actually, the reality, as you explain, is that often systems are a bit strange, and they always have been around the world, every sort of century forever in human society, I'm sure. And, you know, it's a bit like the wind and the tide blows a certain way. But there are some people who put a lot of effort into sailing their boats in the opposite direction. You mentioned a few in the States, people who genuinely care. I go to New City Agenda in Parliament over here, and there are people who are turning up to understand cross-parliamentary, not in a political way, in a very grown-up way, what's actually going on, what are the challenges, and all that kind of stuff. And either the people burn everything down and there's another revolution, or actually what happens is at some point in time, and we've spoken about this before in terms of all the changes we've seen in our lifetimes, at some point, politicians do actually change stuff.
Yeah.
Because they're the ones that sit at the top in terms of strategic governments.
Yeah.
Who's the ultimate strategic governance bit at the top? It's the politicians. So it's really good that academics are working on this. It's really good that some politicians are engaged. I think I like the buyback economy. It's a nice thing that sticks in the mind. I will show it on LinkedIn and Twitter when you get it launched. And it's almost like we need something which draws together these kind of threads and perhaps political threads at the same time. And so there can then be a package which, come the right political will and come the need, gets implemented in the States or in UK or Germany, wherever it gets first, which is then actually kind of like best practice, which can be copied by others. And I think, you know, one of the ones that I was very slow, I was told about this 20 years ago, actually, I think when Reagan was re-elected the first time, I had lunch, cut a long story short, with someone very influential who knew the top 50 funders of Ronnie Reagan and gave me a little sort of bit of insight about that. And it didn't really land enough. And I heard the same thing over here about political funding, didn't really land. But now I've spotted that that's a key thing. So, you know, I've never really liked the idea of publicly funded politicians, but for the sake of argument, let's just say you gave everybody who wanted to be a politician $1,000 and that was it. You know, that'd just be a different way of running the system. And so it is actually possible to deconstruct the system that's been put there. And the final point, not wanting to slow all politicians, I don't want to slow all companies. I was listening to a Russell Brand podcast with a broadcaster about corporatism and that kind of stuff the other day. And he said the thing that's interested him in recent years is speaking to FTSE CEOs. A lot of them, he said, sound like they come from the Occupy movement. They know this is what's going on, and actually they want to fix it because they don't want their chateau burnt down.
Yeah.
And not all their great-grandchildren are going to be CEOs of corporates.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, at the end of the day, people want to benefit society, especially when they've got so much money in their pocket. So I thank you very much for that, Bill, and I'm more optimistic at the end of this podcast than the start, which is good, and I hope the audience is, and I wish you every success with your ventures.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you have consulting, advisory / non-exec, or media needs in the FS or fintech space, get in touch with me at mike@londonfintechpodcast.com.
We could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. To come away from the city, the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, but with the faces so gray, with the pain of the everyday. are wild, like the mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me. 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 Watch the firelight dance.